Well, I'm delighted to be able to introduce Dominic Severs tonight, who is going to be speaking on a subject which won him the RIBA President's Medal for his dissertation at the end of his architectural studies. He's a practicing architect, but quite evidently has also been doing historical research and research into really the relationship between historical things and current practice and what
we'll see. Yeah.
Yes, right, fine. Well, over to you.
And the light's going to.
Yes, by all means, yes. Will work.
Lovely. I probably don't need to be so dark.
But...
Do you want to?
Put the background.
Yeah, the back ones are all right.
Thank you.
Is that all right? I'll start with a couple of quotes as an introduction. From 1856. Pausing before that dark archway, glance into the pandemonium that lies beyond. Within that court you shall find another and still another court, winding and twisting like a viper's brood, the one within the other. Yes, within the limited precincts exists vice of every kind, ruffianism of every hue. No wretch so foul but here may find a refuge and a home. And from 2001, the violence suggests a prevalent instinct towards riot, which has never been suppressed. It is necessary only to look into the inner courtyards of the council house estate, with graffiti on every wall, the windows covered with metal grills and the doors padlocked. Well, I'm going to be talking about those two types of housing. The densely packed lodgings of the poorest in 19th century London, the so-called rookeries, and 20th century local authority built modernist housing estates. I'll be drawing parallels between them, parallels in the responses they provoked, including fear, in the way they were represented, although I'll only touch on that as it's quite a big subject. And alternative forms of housing promoted in their place. And I will be spending some time talking about the 19th century, so not strictly as this organisation may have presented. My proposition is that the responses were rooted in the spatial character of the rookery and the modernist no-go estate, and the close association of this with the character of their inhabitants, at least in the minds of outsiders. So when this illustration was published, housing of the poorest had been seen as a hazard to health and morality for a while, and controlling legislation was passed. Those controls expanded through the rest of the century, and although the laws usually came with the heading public health, the intentions and effects were broader. One of the effects was the proscription of housing set around enclosed courts or narrow alleys isolated from the network of carriage streets, the typical non-street housing of the overcrowded rookery. Instead, the fully self-contained single-family terraced house set on a wide public street was promoted. Well, in the 1970s and 80s, particularly, some forms of state-built housing attracted hostility equal to that shown to the rookeries. Motives behind attacks were complex, and opposition to the state providing housing at all was an underlying theme. But attacks typically focused, and still do, on the so-called failure of housing estates, and particularly those easily identified by their divergence from the housing patterns established in the 19th century. So these no-go estates are, characteristically, high-rise, modernist, and non-street. And this is Broadwater Farm in Tottenham, where we'll be spending most of the time this evening. Well, to start with the spatial character of the rookery, and the route from the public carriage street to the threshold of the private room. Well, the first approach would usually be through a narrow passage, often a covered way, which led to enclosed and overlooked courts or alleys leading one to the other. Then entering the always open door of the tenemented house, a way had to be found to the separately occupied subdivisions of the original rooms, one leading to another, and reportedly, sometimes, knocked through to lead from one house to the next. So progress from the street to the hearth, if there was one, was through a series of spaces increasingly divorced from the wholly public, leading deeper into the territory of the rookery's denizen, and increasingly difficult for an outsider to navigate. The isolation from day-to-day and commercial life on the carriage street was also commented on. Few pass through Church Lane who are not members of its own select society. None else have any business there, and if they had, they would find it in their interest to get out of it as soon as possible. So that's a quote from 1878. Well, the topography was distinctive, and this was identified closely with the moral or immoral character of its inhabitants. In Charles Booth's famous social mapping of London in the last decades of the 19th century, the lowest category, in black, is picked out around those back courts and yards. And black is not an economic category like the others, but a moral one, vicious, semi-criminal. So accounts of the rookery typically wrap together its spatial character with this characterisation of its inhabitants, and the fear expressed was of the rookery as a reservoir of vice and disease, which were seen as two sides of the same coin, and crime. In this account, the committee reviewing the private act of Parliament to demolish the Church Lane rookery in St Giles heard evidence in the 1830s. The chairman asks, "Is there any sewers there?" Mr Waring, the proposer of the scheme, replies, "No, all land drainage." "Would it be capable of having a sewer if the alterations took place?" "Yes, decidedly. The district is in the very centre of London, and it borders on the principal streets, and it's the resort of thieves, prostitutes, and others of the most depraved characters, and for a safe retreat, even from the present police." "Where the police would not follow them." "Where alone, they dare not follow them, even in George Street, where there is a police station." So a straightforward question on sanitation prompts a broad denunciation. Mr. Waring didn't talk about the spatial character of the rookery that time, but then his proposal was to cut through it with a 20-metre-wide road. So that was the first physical response to the rookery, the straightforward demolition by private act of Parliament, and that was New Oxford Street. It's a bit out of focus, actually, is there? One of the many improvements that targeted notorious rookeries like St Giles, so you can get your orientation there. That's the end of Oxford Street, British Museum, as you can see. Well, the snag with the blunt approach was that the rookery simply popped up elsewhere as the displaced packed themselves into the neighbouring streets. So even 60 years after that clearance, the remnants of the rookeries remained in the area on Booth's map around there, the black. So the limitations of private action were recognised, and once the taboo was, on state intervention was broken by the need to deal with cholera in the 1840s, two distinct lines of state action begun. One of these was indirect, by setting up the regulations of the form of housing through local authorities and the building bylaws, and the other was direct action in clearance and eventually in building housing for the working classes. So I'll quickly skim over the first foray into direct action by the state. This came in 1875 when the local authorities, including the Metropolitan Board of Works for London, were given powers to compulsory purchase and clear whole areas on the basis of, to quote the Act, closeness, narrowness and bad arrangement, rather than individual buildings being removed purely on sanitary grounds, which had been the situation before. So the rookery could be condemned as a whole by law because of its plan. And another area of St Giles was targeted, the Wild Street rookery, that triangle there. So this is the area compulsory purchased and cleared. Well, the idea was that sites like this would be assembled and cleared with public funds, then taken over by private enterprise in the form of the model dwelling companies to build wholesome housing and avoid the knock-on overcrowding that had been caused by the improvements and railway clearances. And that's Orange Court, one of those lanes just before the clearance, worthy of illustration, and that's what replaced it. Those are model dwellings of the Peabody Donation Fund. Well, these were fairly sanitary, but there were problems with the model dwellings from almost everyone's point of view. And in terms of the ideal, or the model in the name, that they were supposed to carry to the working classes, well, it was something like this. An approximation to the middle class ideals of domesticity, which meant self-containedness, as they said then, privacy, exclusion of paid work from the home, a degree of segregation of the sexes and gendered spheres of operation, and spatial differentiation of use. Sorry, this is the, well, as you can see, it's the exhibited at the Great Exhibition. So completely self-contained, with a scullery and toilet in the flat, three bedrooms with separated access, parents' room isolated from the children's, keeping parents from the children, boys from girls, to guard against immodesty, or more bluntly, incest. So communality suppressed, self-contained privacy promoted for health and morality. 30-odd years later, Peabody Wild Street buildings diverged by some margin from that ideal. So this is the plan. Communal toilet and scullery, that is a sink and laundry on each floor, and an undifferentiated plan for the flat itself, with one room leading to the other, and only two bedrooms. So typically there'd be a family, or, well, usually a family of five or more living in the three rooms. So not much privacy or differentiation of space, and maybe some immodesty. Well, the external layout fell well short of the ideal as well. The closed courtyards with narrow access combined with the very high density population to recreate some of the spatial qualities and the communality of the old forms of housing, but on a grander scale. Well, as when one of the many critics said, wherever even a small number of the undisciplined are admitted to the blocks, or where being admitted there is not real living rule exercised, regulations are to no avail. No public inspection can possibly for more than an hour or two secure order. No resident superintendent has at once conscience, nerve and devotion single-handed to stem the violence, the dirt, the noise, the quarrels. Well, that was Octavia Hill reporting for Booth's project in 1891, and not a fan of the Peabody Fund. Well, they had drainage and clean water, but the internal and external arrangements, the physical and spatial form, did not tally with the ideals of behaviour and domestic life being promoted. Those two blocks were bombed in the Second World War and weren't rebuilt, so it's a bit more open now. Well, many critics, but it was the model dwellings' financial failure that killed them as a vehicle for policy. The heavy compensation rules and the economic downturn around 1880 saw the Metropolitan Board of Works lumbered with the sites and take a massive loss on the sale of about £1.25 million. So much for direct action. Well, at the same time, running in parallel with that policy for those central high-density model dwellings, the policy for the dispersal of the working classes to the suburbs and the indirect control of that form of housing through model bylaws have been making progress. And here is a typical Victorian working class suburb, part of Tottenham, pretty much fully developed in 1913. For this kind of Victorian townscape, the streets and their terraced houses are so familiar that it's difficult to see past that familiarity to the will and the intention that created them. Well, they weren't planned, maybe, in the 20th century sense, but they certainly were the product of a deliberate system with intended results. The point is that the suburb was not the product of unconscious and uncontrolled economic and social forces. When this map was published in 1864, regulation of the form of housing and the nature of the streets had been in place for 20 years in Tottenham. Industrial dwellings companies were assessing the returns available and in discussion with the railway company, which itself was surveying for a commuter branch line. And generally, the social merits and economics of dispersing the working classes to the suburbs was a matter of public interest, political debate, and would shortly be pursued as a matter of policy. So this is 1882, 10 years after the suburban railway, which is running there, was opened. By then, development was well underway, with specialist dwellings companies specialising in working class housing and speculative builders contributing, all within the bylaw system. This is the Mount Pleasant estate, and that's Broadwater Farm. And this has been laid out for speculative development, which a year later, the roads and drains were completed, according to the bylaws, at substantial cost, usually about a quarter to the third of the final cost of the buildings, and transferred to the local authority. The plots laid out ready for auction for this man, the artisan builder, who would build one or maybe five or ten, and perhaps end up owning a couple as a landlord. Well, the houses don't really need illustration, but this one's a non-speculative one built by one of the dwellings companies, and the other one a speculative one a little bit later, looking slightly grander, but probably with two families living in it rather than one. And here in the suburb, the ideal of the single family house in plan could be fully realised. A third class house, 16 foot frontage, achieves the ideal with the necessary three bedrooms, all corridor and separate access, separation of functions with the bonus of a parlour. Even the washing could be done in the house with the copper and the drying space. And there are the occupants. The artisan commuter of the 1880s alighting from the Enfield and Tottenham line at Liverpool Station, third class. With their shilling season tickets in their waistcoat pockets. Well, their life had probably taken them from a country cottage somewhere, Wicklow or Dorset or somewhere, maybe a few months or a few years in the rookery when they first arrived in London in a common lodging house, then more respectable lodgings, maybe the model dwelling before suburbanisation, and then possibly back to the city when the economics of moving out didn't work out. Well, the contrast of the artisan's new home on the bylaw street with the rookery, or the enclosed court, was absolute. The street was decisively and literally public. Its status was clear, as was the status of the threshold with the home, the private realm. The communality of the inner city and the shared life in our court was broken up. Private activities were to be exactly that, with no more washing of dirty linen in public. So the relationship embodied by this spatial arrangement was between the self-contained family and the state, or the national economy, with no intermediary, establishing a clear right of the state, the law, the church, or less dramatically, the postman, to reach every threshold. Well, to refer back to the rookery, one of the intentions behind the Bylaw Street is perhaps summed up by a commentator who called for the perforation of every such nest by carrying through the midst of it a free and open street that would let in that eye, with a capital E, and observation which would effectually break up their combinations. Well, the reference is to the need for street improvements, but it might easily be said to represent the rationale for the requirements of the building bylaws. The inference is that the spatial arrangement of the bylaw street is, in conception, a vast city-scale panopticon. Well, the hope was certainly aligned with Bentham's declaration. Morals reformed, health preserved, industry invigorated, instruction diffused, public burdens lightened, economy seated, all by a simple idea in architecture. The greatest claim ever made, probably, for architecture. Well, maybe. In any case, it was goodbye to the communality of the court. The court, our court, is condemned. That's the end of the 19th century, we'll be pleased to hear. So, 70 years on from that last image, and here we are back in Tottenham. Here are those bylaw streets, that's Mount Pleasant Road. A Peabody cottage, as they ventured into suburban development. And the London County Council Tower Gardens estate, an early one. All built on bylaw lines. And then the edge of the White Hart Lane estate, built on, also London County Council, built on garden suburb design principles a little later. And there, stark in its difference, stunning, really quite beautiful, the Broadwater Farm estate, shining new and in fact not quite complete in 1972. The last phase of the development of this working-class suburb. So different and needing some explanation. Well, to give the vital statistics, Broadwater Farm was conceived and built by the newly formed London Borough of Haringey, conceived in 66, finished in 73, designed by the borough architect. It's a high-density, just, mixed, which I'll come back to, housing estate, with just over 1,000 flats and around 3,000 residents. 21 acres, giving a density of about 140 people persons per acre, which was probably about the same as the bylaw streets in their heyday. Two 18-storey towers of one-bedroom flats, 9 six-storey towers with internal corridors, 10 four-storey slabs of doubled-up maisonettes with the traditional balcony access. Then there's the exotic ziggurat building, Tangmere, commercial and residential, and the 37 terraced houses, not complete there. All the blocks built on stilts over open car parking, and built with a prefabricated concrete panel system, the Larsen Nielsen system, by Taylor Woodrow Anglian, the contractors. Even the terraced houses are the concrete panel system. So the blocks are set around squares or large courtyards and all linked with the raised walkways, which are quite complex and sometimes on two levels, or were, and serve to fully enclose the squares in places. The names, by the way, are Second World War airfields. So I'm going to talk about the spatial character and the origins of Broadwater Farm Estate, but first a short detour into defensible space. Well, Oscar Newman's book, Defensible Space, was published as Broadwater Farm was being completed in 1972. And it was, and probably still is, influential, particularly amongst those with an axe to grind against high-rise, state-built, modernist housing. And the eventual physical alterations made at Broadwater Farm were framed by Newman's ideas. Well, Newman, supported with a great deal of evidence, analysed the impact of the physical design on the relationship between the apartment and the street and the route between them. His focus was on crime, but he drew conclusions on the effect of physical design on social structure and the formation of communities, and communities taking responsibility for their surroundings. His evidence was collected from public housing projects in the States, in which the traditional urban street stoop tenement, the stoop being the short flight of steps to the front door relationship, had been abandoned, and instead, commonly, large arrays of high-rise blocks were set in grounds disassociated from the street. The projects, incidentally, were a long way in conception and realisation from most state-built housing in Britain at the time. Anyway, for this non-street housing, after analysing the failings of the typical layouts, Newman described the best cases where beneficial arrangements to allow passive or natural surveillance, together with symbolic and real barriers marking gradations of privacy, could define territory, semi-public, semi-private, private, fostering a feeling of proprietorship or territoriality in residents, extending beyond their threshold, so that, as an outsider, one is passing from a space which is public, where one's presence is not questioned, through a barrier to a space which is private, where one's presence requires justification. Well, with this in mind, back in Tottenham, and the spatial character of Broadwater Farm, and the journey from the street to the threshold of the flat. Well, entering the estate from the familiar Bylaw Streets, I think this is Griffin Road, one crosses past the 10-metre buffer of waste ground, literally a cordon sanitaire as required by the building regulations, and you're met with the local authority sign which confirms that navigation around the estate may not be easy, but offers encouragement with its cheerful lettering. Then, in its original form, you would have had the choice of climbing the stairs or ramp to the walkway, or as now, passing under the building to its ground level entrance. Then to the communal stair and lift, corridor or balcony, and at last to the threshold of the home, by which time the neutrality of the public street is a long way away, although maybe still visible. One is deep within the territory of the resident. Well, without applying Newman's analysis step by step, it seems that there's a surfeit of markers of progress from the entirely public to the semi-private, and then to the semi-public, and then the semi-private spaces, defining the territory of the estate resident. Certainly, by the time you reach the access balcony, you would probably want to be able to justify your presence if challenged. I'm not saying that Newman would have approved of the design in many aspects, parking with no natural surveillance, building entrances serving too many residents, the interconnecting walkway, and what he would have considered the stigmatising contrast in aesthetics, scale and materials to the surrounding housing. All of these, in his view, would have been invitations to criminals from outside. Well, so much for the relation of the street to the home. What about the other elements of physical spatial design that seem a world away from the neighbouring streets? The covered ways leading to closed courtyards or communal spaces enclosed and overlooked. Even the terraced houses are on the equivalent of a 19th century court. And the estate as a whole is something of a cul-de-sac. There's no through route. Few pass through who are not members of its own select society. Well, so much for the external arrangements, so different from the ideals of housing from a century before and realised in the neighbouring streets. What about the flat, the dwelling? Well, not so radical there. The domestic ideal of the single family home was as strong as ever, and the last communal areas of communal facilities of estates like this were made redundant by the progress of the washing machine. So full self-containedness could finally be achieved. The maisonette, three bedrooms, all corridor separate access, effectively a terraced house plan, although an unusual one with a transverse stair. And even the one-bedroom flat is all corridor and segregated function, bathroom, kitchen, living room, lots of corridor. Well, going back outside, I think the parallels between the spatial and other qualities of Broadwater Farm and the rookery can be safely stated, particularly in the light of the contrast with the suburban, or now probably considered urban, competitor, the Bylaw Street. Distinct self-contained entities, separated from the mainstream of transit and economic activity, difficult to navigate by outsiders, the enclosure, covered entrances creating symbolic barriers or markers of territory, the indirect relationship of the street to the home, and complex and overlapping public and private spaces. The communal territory of the inhabitants extending well beyond their threshold, at least as felt by a visitor. Well, I think all of these fairly describe both. Well, and overall, comparing Broadwater Farm to its neighbours, well, the contrast in scale can maybe, it can be explained by changes in the capital structure of house building. And the aesthetics may be by differences in the aesthetic differences may be by the passing of years and changes in taste or changes in the economics of materials or building methods. Well, the internal layout of the flat suggests that there's been no change in the conception of the family unit and how it might live, although that may have more to do with fire regulations than the intention of the architects. But outside, well, what new ideas were at work? Closed courts like Tangmere and entry to streets and courts by covered ways have been prescribed since the model bylaws of 1858. Why reintroduce these elements? And why connect all the blocks independently of the street? Why create closed courtyards and communal semi-public spaces apparently belonging to the people of the estate? An explanation is demanded. Well, the context for the design and construction of Broadwater Farm was, of course, the acute and persistent housing shortage in the 30 years after the Second World War. Also, the principal role of the state in dealing with that shortage, and the very high ambitions of the period for social as well as physical reconstruction. So for estates like Broadwater Farm, the social aspect of that ambition was central to their design. The ideal in the late 1940s had been for the new estates to be of mixed social class. Bevan, Health Minister and responsible for housing, picturesquely describes single-class estates as castrated communities. Well, the term mixed did stay in policy, but by the time Broadwater Farm was designed, it had been diluted to mean a mix of different housing types. But the idea of building for a community, albeit of a more limited social range, remained the ideal, and I think was largely taken for granted. But in physical terms, this is the policy, the official guidance to local authorities: a mixed high-density estate with 4- and 6-storey slab blocks of maisonettes, tower block or twin tower of flats, and some 2-storey houses. But in terms of layout, there doesn't seem to be much of an overriding principle. It's a bit of a mix, a mishmash, mostly non-street, with half the estate having perimeter blocks defining a central communal amenity space, as it was probably called. I will mention again, though, that it is very different in conception and physical form to the projects examined by Oscar Newman. Well, in terms of modernism, the modern movement in all this, well, rationalist daylighting principles have been abandoned in that guidance, but the idea of the slab and the tower block to achieve the benefits of light, air and green space, which were the agreed central aims of planning, whether modern, garden, suburb, or of the health minister, the housing minister. So the tower block and the slab block had been accepted into policy for estates like this. And although the adoption of the architectural language of modernism had not been officially sanctioned in the way that garden city planning and aesthetics had been after the First World War, the success of estates like Churchill Gardens displaced consideration of designs like this, the 1951 Lansbury model estate, where the buildings, although not the estate layout, were backward looking to the 30s. Well, and the imagery of modernism became popular with local and national politicians who held the purse strings, as they came to believe, at least for a while, that there was an electoral advantage in laying claim to modernity in any context. And of course, if I haven't mentioned it before, the state's role as large-scale builder meant its interests in economies promised by industrialised methods and prefabrication chime with those of modernists. So one way or another, by the end of the 50s, modernism in various varieties was well established in the borough architects' offices. But at the same time, the modern movement, or at least its self-appointed leaders and theorists, were moving on. The functional analysis of the city was displaced by theories that put social interaction and communities at the centre. An example of this was Alison and Peter Smithson's paper, 1953, which included photographs of East End street life and explicitly identified the street as an important arena for social life, or association, as they put it. And they focused on the Bylaw Street and the terraced house of the working classes. They didn't conclude that the Bylaw Street should be preserved, but attempted to reinvent its social use while maintaining a modernist orthodoxy of separation of function and iconography of tall blocks set in their patches of green. The Smithson solution was a reworking of connected raised decks separated from the transport function already seen in modernist and earlier housing. These proposals usually glamorously or derisively referred to as streets in the sky, and in this proposal of theirs extended throughout the city, recreating the social arena swept away by the clearance of the obsolete bylaw streets. Well, this is just one example of the attempt to find mechanisms where to build also means to build towards community structure. They weren't alone, though. There was a general popular re-evaluation of working class urban life and social structures, and a celebration of that culture. And however influential particular architects may have been, the idea that it was worthwhile to try and recreate some of those social structures after the old streets had been bulldozed was pretty much a commonplace. So for a housing estate like Broadwater Farm, the attempt to recreate the social use of the bylaw street and the general concern to build for community led to the device of linked raised decks and the reintroduction of the courtyard to housing of the working classes. While the towers and slabs withdrew from the real street into their patches of green. Well, we've seen the spatial results. What then would be the reaction of outsiders, the responses, when in the 1970s, as the squeeze on local authority housing budgets halted effective maintenance everywhere, policy veered sharply away from the ideal of social mix in Broadwater Farm? Well, an article in the local paper, the Hornsey Journal, a year after completion, was not a good start. I quote, "A report paints a scarifying picture of life on one of the borough's modern tower block estates. The report added to the ammunition already available to those who believe that as tower blocks reach skyward, they reach previously unscaled heights of misery. Problem families, many of them single-parent families, were seen to be placed together. The sight of unmarried West Indian mothers walking about the estate aggravated racial tension. Adolescent absentees from school frequent the blocks, terrorising the elderly. Gangs abound, particularly disturbing, in that the area is a classic breeding ground for antisocial behaviour. The police observe that the estate is inherently difficult to patrol. Individual and gang vandalism, assault and intimidation are high." Well, I'll only touch on the parallels between this sort of representation and that of the rookery, but the wrapping together of crime, immorality, violence with the form of the housing sounds familiar, and there is a casual assertion that it is a classic breeding ground for antisocial behaviour. The casual racism is not so familiar. Well, maybe the most significant item from the for the subsequent history of the estate on that list is that the police considered it to be inherently difficult to patrol. The police did not like their beats in the sky, and this escalated into a major problem by the early 1980s, becoming associated with, to put it neutrally, bad relations between the police and the black residents. Or less neutrally, the racist harassment and the resentment to the police that that generated. The police were afraid of the estate. An account from a worker at the Youth Association in Tangmere gives the flavour. "We told them, you do not need to phone, come in and talk to the members. The first time it ever happened, we had Billy the Kid and the Sundance Kid. They actually kicked open the Youth Association door and stood with hands on hips, holding truncheons, and just looked in." Well, the police certainly regarded the estate as hostile criminal territory, and their view was very significant, central in making Broadwater Farm the location of the riot, the infamous riot on the estate in October 1985. Well, I won't go into the details of the events leading to the riot, but these had little or nothing to do with the estate, except that there was a meeting held in Tangmere, the Ziggurat building, about the death of Mrs. Jarrett, who had died during a police search, not on the estate, but in Stamford Hill. The meeting broke up to go back to demonstrate again outside Tottenham Police Station, about half a mile away. Leaving the estate, would-be protesters met a van of police in riot gear and beat it with their hands. Now, there were 200 police with riot gear in reserve in that area that evening, following riots the week before in Brixton and the rumour of trouble planned for Wood Green, about a mile or so away, a mile and a half. These reserves arrived very promptly and took position at the other road exits to the estate. To quote, about eight lines of police came round the corner of Griffin Road in formation, trotting with all their riot shields, and filled up the road. There was cries of, wait until we get in there and get you, you coons. You don't come out until we tell you. Get back in there. The critical point is that the police formed a cordon at the other entrances before trouble had started. It was not a spontaneous eruption of a prevalent instinct towards riot, but a battle with the police on territory that the police themselves had chosen. And they determined it because of their existing fear of the estate and their assessment of the inhabitants. To quote, it has long been a haven of the wrongdoer. Not a quote from the 1890s, but from the 1980s, from Deputy Assistant Commissioner Richards, who was in charge of the area for the police and wrote the official police report of the riot. Well, for him and for the police, the rookery was still going on, going strong. But in the aftermath, the immediate response to the riot and the mob-handed murder of a policeman in the inner precinct, the courtyard of Tangmere, was outraged press coverage with narratives, the usual narratives, of vice, violence, crime and racial conflict, set in the modernist hell of stained concrete. Postmen stopped deliveries, and there followed 3 months' occupation of the estate by the police, whose expectations and worst fears of Broadwater Farm had, of course, been confirmed. But physical intervention followed. Inevitably, there were calls for demolition, including from Margaret Thatcher, but Haringey certainly would not have paid for that, being more inclined to blame the police than the architecture. But £33 million was found, and quite quickly, by the Department of the Environment, to be spent on a ground-level reinstatement plan, which closely followed Oscar Newman's defensible space recommendations. The connecting walkways were demolished. The broad common platforms cut off from all access. Shops were moved from Tangmere, the Ziggurat Centre, the courtyard in the Ziggurat building, to ground level on Willem Road to make a high street, unsuccessfully, I think. And ground level lobbies were built with lots of glazing for natural surveillance and reassuring materials that were not concrete. Well, it all sounds very reasonable if you accept the very well supported arguments of Oscar Newman. Well, yes, except defensible space was about crime, and the estate was not a high crime area before the riot, whatever statistics you may find quoted in recent reports. The crime rate had in the early 80s been falling rapidly, and the burglary rate was, to quote, much lower than the rest of Tottenham, according to the Lord Gifford's inquiry into the riot. Well, if crime wasn't the reason to spend £30,000 on per flat, which is probably about what they were worth at the time, what was? Well, I'd say that the ground level reinstatement plan was analogous, perhaps the same in purpose, to the opening up of the rookeries and the promotion of the Bylaw Street, to let in that eye of observation and assert the fully public nature of the street and the unambiguous right of access to the threshold of the home, or as close as you can get with a block of flats. For Broadwater Farm, as for the rookery before it, Oscar Newman's argument was turned on its head. Newman had always, scrupulously so, taken the point of view of the resident, for whom crime was always an external threat, and Oscar Newman never specified where that threat was from. From the point of the view of the police and much of the British press, the situation was reversed. The criminals were on the inside, and the policy, the spatial policy to be followed, was one of stripping away those semi-public, semi-private, and so on, spaces that marked their territory and had made the space so defensible in October 1985. Well, that's the sort of conclusion. But there are two things that probably need a bit more discussion. One is fear in the title, and the other is determinism, the idea that behaviour is determined by the physical spatial environment, which has been a very strong thread running through this talk. So, what first, fear. What was the nature of the fear of the rookery and the modernist estate? Well, the 19th century literature is full of sensational tales of crime, filth, vice, death, and sex. And public health was the rallying cry. You would think that contagion, moral and physical, and crime were the anxieties. But when you look at the actual actions of the state, virtually all the measures of amelioration were directed at the upper tiers of the working classes. The artisan, as the periodical The Builder quoted in 1881, quoting a police surgeon's report to an inquest, the poorer classes were now a great deal worse off than before the Metropolitan Improvements and the Peabody Trust were ever carried out. In reference to that trust, he could not help saying that it had been worse than useless. Instead of finding the poor and needy in the Peabody buildings, the better class of artisans, earning £2 or £3 a week, are still in possession of the rooms. The abject poor and their ill-clad, half-starved children still inhabited the styes to be found all over the metropolis. Well, those are the model dwellings we looked at earlier, and you can see on Booth's map they're firmly in the pink, which is fairly comfortable, good, ordinary earnings. And popular with policemen's families, according to Booth's reporter. The poorest, the residuum, as they were called, were dispersed and left to shift for themselves, or rely on the poor laws, or, of course, to die. Well, that suggests that a different threat was being met. The political threat of the artisan, a class rising in its economic power and courted by socialists and anarchists. Well, maybe the relevant narratives would then be ones of uprising, revolutionary thought and political change, and riots, rather than slums and sanitation. In taking this view, the crucial event was the extension of the franchise to the upper working classes in 1867. Having given the artisan the vote, he now had to be educated, his life ordered, and his political understanding coaxed away from revolutionary ideas. By that view, the bylaw streets, they're not physical crystallisation of control, but a spatial expression of the process of incorporating the upper working classes into the main fabric of society and the economy, on the established patterns of the middle classes, a process to which the artisan was probably a willing party. And what of the no-go estate, the modernist estate? Well, here again, the stories have been crime and violence, and occasionally vice. But political fear, or political struggle at least, was significant. In the immediate aftermath of the riots, Kenneth Newman, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, had claimed, groups of Trotskyists and anarchists have been identified as orchestrating the disturbance. Well, this was an attempt to explain the hostility to the police, perhaps, rather than to be taken seriously, and it was dismissed, I think, generally. But there was a political issue of underlying importance, and that was the ideas that the buildings themselves represented. To quote Gifford again, they believed it would be an everlasting memorial to their achievements, which was the said of the Haringey Housing Committee, who built Broadwater Farm. Well, in the battle over the state's role in housing, the significance of grandiose schemes like Broadwater Farm as monuments to socialist policies and municipal power stimulated and magnified hostility to them, a hostility that delighted in the propagation of tales of crime, terror and despair. Yet, while other estates have seen demolition, with tower blocks crashing down like so many bronze Lenins, down on the farm at least, the fiscal interventions were less dramatic, although still wildly expensive. Really more spatial reconciliation than triumphalism. And I think this reflects the local balance of political power and the political power of the residents themselves, who form a substantial part of a reliable Labour ward, unlike the denizens of the rookery. Well, what of determinism? The belief that physical environment, architecture, can modify or determine the way people behave. And we've seen quite a bit of it in the last hour, ranging from the most extreme claims of Jeremy Bentham for his panopticon, to Henry Roberts' model three-bedroom cottage to combat immodesty, to the post-war modernists with their speculative designs for community, and Oscar Newman's defensible space. But the validity of determinism, whether the plan of the house or the street, or the urban structure, actually determine people's behaviour, and whether it is right to try to do to influence their behaviour, is maybe not the point. All of those architectural expressions must necessarily embody some conception of how they will or should be used, and this conception can only ever be a model, either in the sense of an ideal or the sense of a useful approximation or generalisation. Can't possibly anticipate the full variety of reality and change. To have a conception of how the house or the street are to be used and how life is to be conducted, whether explicit or implicit, does not necessarily imply a belief or attempt at determinism. It's simply impossible to build anything without that conception. And actual use is a different matter. Those single-family terraced houses in Tottenham were almost always occupied by more than one family. They knew what the ideal was, but they lived in two rooms. I argued quite strongly that the bylaw street was intended to break up communality, but 60 years later, they were being celebrated as central to working-class communities. Well, in any case, with the passage of time, the economic circumstances of the moment and the intentions of the designers or legislators are inevitably forgotten and become irrelevant. Community and attachment to place, of course, come with time and with memories. As the witness to one tower block demolition recalled, as her memories were raised, there was so much dust, and all I could hear in my head was the radio that my mother always had on in the kitchen. I had to turn away. And what of Broadwater Farm? Well, it's become the subject for a new type of narrative. To quote again, something like a miracle followed this descent into murderous chaos. Broadwater Farm wasn't demolished, but transformed for the better. Its grey expanses were broken up with colourful mosaics. On-site workshops were opened so that tenants could learn skills and run their own businesses. There were no robberies and only one burglary in 2005, down from 850 in 1985. Hyperbole, and inaccurate statistics, but this kind of narrative bears comparison with the accounts of working class life in the 1950s of Jane Jacobs and Young and Wilmot in its revision of a previously reviled urban form, although by no means as rigorous as their studies. Then the bylaw streets and terraced houses, or the street stoop tenement, were acclaimed for the humane environment of social and kinship ties which they apparently encouraged. But I think it was probably no accident that those reassessments coincided with a period of unprecedented prosperity and political power for the residents of those streets. Well, and maybe under conditions of prosperity and social stability, and with its role as a totem for socialism forgotten, the high-density council estate might have its own golden age. Well, at least in the narratives of the journalists and the social commentators. And that's the end. Thank you very much. Yes, I have. There is one thing I would say, actually, before that, is that there's a whole sort of parallel discussion about representation, and there's a lot of continuities in the appetite for representations of these separate entities to outsiders, and the lives of the people in them, or the imagined lives of the people in them, but I couldn't really cover that this evening. Anyway, thank you.
Yes, possibly, yeah.
I find that absolutely fascinating, but also very disturbing. There are two points that you haven't covered, except maybe a weekly. We're talking about council tenants, and council tenants have a problem invariably with management, or management has a problem with tenants. Tenancies. You didn't mention that at all.
No.
The other thing is that it's a common occurrence that the local area and the councillors will denigrate an estate, and I speak with good personal knowledge of such, and will always say, oh, it's that problem, it's that problem. So.
You mean that the estate is causing problems?
No, oh. It is actually the people outside the estate that actually create an atmosphere and an attitude about the activities and the residents in the estate.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, it's people outside who are laying that image on the...
So there are many examples of certain high-rise buildings or 1960s, 70s buildings which have been deemed to be a failure by the local authority, so they sold it on, but then subsequently been occupied by people who like where they're living and whether there has been attention to management. And it's management, 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 all the way through. And my background is in housing, not only in Britain, going back to the days of the OCC, but in Black America, where there were riots and all that sort of thing. And I live in Churchill Gardens. And I've lived in Churchill Gardens estate, which is a very fine estate, but somewhat different from the estate you're talking about. But in the 33 years that I've lived there, the council have denigrated the estate, and if there's any bother anywhere, oh, it's on Churchill Gardens estate. If there's an accident, if there's a crime, if there's a murder, it's Churchill Gardens. It isn't Churchill Gardens. I established the largest neighbourhood watch in the country, because we have a population of 5,000. And we had proper meetings with the police and with the management authority and representatives from most of the blocks. We met every month. The police presented their figures and said, well, the crime figures are this. The crime was in fact domestic violence. That was the level of the crime. But the councillors would say, month after month,
high crime rate.
The Church of God is an area of crime. And I had to go back to the council and say, with the figures of the police, you're talking nonsense. And the disparagement that has issued from the council for over 30 years of Churchill Gardens estate is just mind-blowing.
Well, I think...
So I was used that as a parallel as to what was happening around Lord Brown.
Well, it sounds like there's been little change in that situation then, because I think that's been that sort of denigration has been going on a very long time. And I think a lot of that has to do with the demonisation of the residents, as you referred to, and also the symbolic importance of very significant estates like Churchill Gardens, that they are so different and they still carry a symbolism for socialism, really, even though it was Westminster City Council under a Conservative control that built it, as it happened. But
well, it was mixed rental,
yeah. Well, I mean, as I said, that was the objective, was the mixed community. And council housing in the UK has really been, or state-funded housing, has been pulled by two ideologies since the outset, and the problem of who they are for has never been resolved. It's been swinging from one to the other. The idea that the state has a role in providing housing, and it's general housing for everyone, and the opposing view that state has no role but will make interventions from time to time to deal with certain problems, as in slum clearance, which is the opposing view. And because policy has swung between the two, you get a design in conception for a mixed, for a community, and then policy swings back the other way, and you end up with a very narrow population of people, the most vulnerable people on the lowest incomes in that estate. And that's happened over and over again. 1930s, that happened. Cottage estates were built on Garden City principles for whole communities, and ended up being filled with slum clearance. And exactly the same denigration and problems arose then. And the lack of commitment, the thing about maintenance and management is the lack of commitment by some authorities to that. And external factors, the problems in the 70s were that all housing budgets were under enormous pressure. They'd borrowed money to build these estates on market interest rates. Rates went through the roof. They tried to continue building, and it was maintenance that was halted. It was a general problem, not the residents. Sorry.
Peter first.
Yeah, like Tom, I've spent my life in housing and worried about all the problems you've been talking about. Two things, one coming out of the other. It's not high density anyway.
No, it's just,
when
I think...
All the revisions in the, 15, 20 years ago now, to the idea of densities in town were revised. Chelsea was taken as a good example at 400 to the acre as opposed to the 136. You're talking about, but anyway, how would
you mean now that's the standard, is it?
Yeah, 400, yeah, sure, or anything above that. I come from Wandsworth,
yeah,
and you know, the sky's the limit.
Well, the wild street,
anyway,
yeah, so
that aside, what would your suggestion be for any designer doing housing? How would you approach things in the future?
Would I incorporate Oscar Newman's recipes?
It's a big subject, and I wallow in it, and I can't decide one thing or another.
Well, the people of that estate, they liked the estate. They resented the portrayal of the estate, and resisted demolition. And their view of it was always, the problem to be addressed is the external view rather than the actual performance. That I think that estate is fine.
How should architects be briefed?
How should they be briefed?
Yeah.
Well, should the brief be the Peabody dwellings or the Oscar Newman's projects, where the brief there is maximum number of people on this site with the whatever constraints? Or should it be you're building for a community?
Half of the problems at ground level, you were saying at Broadwater Farm, have disappeared in a lot of schemes currently, all private, mostly private, as somebody in some authority in the Institute said some years ago, the car parking space has been neatly tucked underground. Mm. Personally, I think car parking spaces are dens of iniquity if you want to get bashed up going in a car park, I should think.
Well, I never have been bashed up in a car park.
I'm just trying to get out of something. Yeah. But how do you get at these sort of issues? Really?
Well, I mean, a lot of the Oscar Newman sort of analysis has been, if you read Defensible Space Now, it reads like ancient history because his description of the city is not recognisable.
It's around when it was written.
Yeah, well, I'm...
Anyway...
Well, you know more about it than me.
I think it actually the whole issue of determinism and questioning that came up very well. Emma?
Thank you. I'm a councillor in Kensington and Chelsea.
Hello.
Trellick Tower is in my ward.
Lovely.
And, you know, I've got an answer for Peter, actually, who's one of these buildings I'm trying to save because it's beautiful. And local people don't want it knocked down at all. It's sort of finish that. Having been on the board of the TMO, which manages all the council estate in Kensington and Chelsea, you know, from Trellick Tower to World's End and everything in between, I've got an answer. What should the architect's brief be? And I remember a few years ago, because I've written a lot about social housing, both in Spain, in the heady days, let's not even think about what's going on there now, there was an idea that when you quoted for putting up a building, you also quoted for its maintenance into the future, and you structured that, and you said how it should be maintained and so on. And I don't know how long this idea lasted. It was an architect in Madrid who explained it to me. They said their public housing there, they had this built into it. So they had all the programs of maintenance and management planned into that from the outset, and that was part of the cost. So if you were going to have ridiculous windows, you had to say how much it was going to cost to clean those.
Yeah.
And all those other things that architects love so much, that, you know, floor to ceiling windows and an area where it's all old people and they want their curtains supposedly. All the simple everyday practicalities were built into the design. And you didn't just say, you know, we're going to have the best architect in the world to design some fabulous social housing and then you've just got to cope with it somehow.
You only do that if you need planning permission.
it absolutely, and I sit on planning so well. I think that was part of it.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of research into the whole picture, which is rather what Tom's saying, which is about the management maintenance and building that has to be knitted together. And you can't just let architects have their way all the time and present, you know, beautiful buildings without any constraints, because to keep them that fabulous, they actually, the management and funding of that and maintenance into the future.
Yeah.
I know that Peter's building has never been maintained, they've never been in the gutters, 40 years, it's outrageous, ever, you know, never. That's one way of doing it.
Historical sort of perspective on that, of course, that problem of maintenance and capital structure in the 1960s, what was being demolished? All those terraced houses on Bylaw and Peat, because the capital structure and the funding of maintenance had broken down. All the houses that were built...
Some of them were badly built as well, but yes.
But so the tenure structure and capital structure, which is a, you know, a whole different subject and worthy of many hours, it's critical. And the failure of... I said that policy on public housing had this duality, general needs or slum clearance. But the temporary policies of housing for slum clearance went on for 100 years. There was no end to the new slums that came on the conveyor belt.
New slums now on board,
but it's to do with the long-term financial security of the people living or owning them. The breakdown of all those terraced houses, the tenure was rental. There was no stigma associated with rental. Lots of small landlords. After 1915, rent controls intermittently undermined that. Capital value was undermined by out-of-town development in the 30s. There was no money in those houses. They weren't very well built, and they weren't maintained for 30 or 40 years. No wonder they were slums in the 50s and 60s.
I think that's the thing. It has to be inferred, actually, because the architecture has to be brilliant, but also funding to the future and the maintenance. It should be inferred. It should be complete.
Yeah.
That's
well, in public housing or state...
About sitting on the board of, you know, trying to work out how to get, make, you know, to get the funding together to repair Trellick Tower and all the rest of it.
Yeah, well, I'll bear that in mind when I bid.
Philip?
Yes, sorry. I thought your narrative of the optimism and the tragedy was very, very clear. But there are some factual things that went on in policy, not to do with architecture.
Yeah.
Between 63 and 72.
Hold on, I get my notes.
you were right in commenting on the fact that the effect of the washing machine, all right, on containment of dwellings.
Yeah.
The other big thing about realities and perceptions that happened in this 63 to 72 period was the car, and what you should do with the car in an urban, high-density area. It was clearly, obviously, a problem, because your ordinary street with your 30-foot car and your 15-foot frontage house meant there wasn't enough room for the cars.
Yeah.
Numbers of people noticed this during that period. And with regard to the government policy towards how housing should be, this was perceived as being a problem, right, that you needed more room for cars. You didn't know how many, how few, or how much, but for more. So to do that, we have to try and encourage people doing volume housing to accommodate larger volumes of cars.
You're saying that was the policy then?
There was a government policy, and the way that government policy was implemented was in the council housing, to gain substitute building, because it was part of the money to get the permission to do that, the cost of it has to be agreed. And the way that was agreed was that they had tables between 63, sorry, earlier than that, until mid-70s, they had tables of what it cost to build council housing.
Yeah, with cars. Housing handbook.
Housing handbook, yes. And that was turned into a thing called the housing cost yardstick, which was a chart for people who were doing new housing to tell them how much they could spend. But within this chart, it was biased. They built in a factor to put in more cars. Right?
So there was an incentive.
So there was an incentive to put in, and it was a straight line graph, that the more cars you put in,
the more money
you got. And that was, you know, a blunt instrument, which had an influence on, by 72, and schemes by which is basically a mixed development scheme with courtyards. The fact of having to squeeze in this number of cars to get enough money to pay for the balconies on that triangular block was a familiar thing that the architect and designing house at that time had to go through, and various solutions were adopted. sadly there, the one for the car windows, it was to lift up the dwellings and you sit them underneath a ground level. So the area you would pass through to go from the street to your front door was the car area.
Yeah, well that's the situation.
The second thing that happened during that period too was the nature of how compulsory purchase orders were used in order to purchase land.
Yeah.
If you bought one house, you know, you had a house in a terrace, you could buy it, but you didn't have any relationship with the street. If you bought two or three houses, still didn't have very much relationship with the street. But if you bought the houses on opposite sides of the street, legally, you're the ownership extended to the middle of the yeah. road. So suddenly, if you bought houses on two sides of a by-law street, or two terraces either side of a by-law street, you had a lump of land. If you demolished those houses and if you took away the road, you then got a larger piece of land on which to build. And that, as an incentive for people doing high-density housing, was very important in how you built up sites, right, by adding pieces of land together.
So the
Broadwater is an example among a large number of streets. Well, you could buy land by doing compulsory purchase orders. You could get land of that sort of volume and shape, which would in turn influence the size of the states and how you manipulate. And if you've got more room in them, and actually with the thing of terraces, doing them economically and solving the car problem, you tended to go towards the sort of solutions that you've got.
That was actually allotments before they already owned the site in that case. But so there was an incentive for more car parking, an incentive for the non-streets.
Over that period, by the mid-70s, the whole thing changed again.
It was very rapid.
Very instrumental. They were direct policy. They were architectural decisions. They were policy ones in terms of how you did housing, but they had a very big effect on the way that sort of housing was designed.
Yes.
But I think very, very quick.
Well, just a comment. I have no sort of architectural expertise, but I got involved in local campaign groups. But I live next to an estate known as the Packington Estate.
Isn't it off Essex Road?
Yes.
Is it? I used to have a dentist there.
And the dread of Packington. And one, yes, if you've got a big estate like that with no sort of easy throughway, I mean, I would just never go near it.
How outside the sea it?
Yes,
it's... Because it was structurally unsound from the beginning.
Did you know anyone who lived there?
I didn't happen to,
no. No, I just wondered what the perspective was from the other side, because of I mean, that's the crucial, one of the crucial things.
If I knew somebody there, I would have had to go in. Maybe my next door neighbour who was born in the house, she lived in. I mean, they were going to knock her house down, my house down, the whole way across Peter Street and further, but sort of stopped. And now it's been knocked down and rebuilt. There was a lot of consultation. And everybody said, some people didn't like the estate, they got to like their neighbours and things. But everybody just said, we want the old street back. Can we have Dane Street back? Can we have the old street plans? Can we have houses as much like the surrounding houses?
Which perhaps had something to do with the stigmatisation of the...
But they liked the street, the Bylaw Street, I suppose. You know, Mrs. Stanley, when his next thing was born in the house, they hadn't the money, but they poured concrete into the basement to save it before the council knocked it down as structurally unsound. You know, yes, it cost a bomb to maintain.
Yeah.
But what people wanted when they were asked was the old sort of housing, you know, sort of early Victorian terrace houses, even if they're council, if that's the word. As few people as possible to the common edge.
When are you talking about? What period is that you're talking about?
I don't know when it was built, but I suppose it was 66. Philip, do you know?
Yes, it's about 66.
The only...
Now it's been knocked down, anything was being built back
into. I think, before the Second World War, the Bylaw Street had a terrible reputation. Really, you know, it was condemned by everyone, really.
My neighbour loved the street.
I'm sure. But what I'm saying is really the perceptions change. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with external factors. In the 30s, these houses built mostly around 1900... we're in a shocking condition.
These are earlier.
Not those particular ones, but I'm talking generally. you know, for a long time, no maintenance, and and they were slums. But they can be. It's not to do with the building. It's to do with
perceptions.
Yeah, perceptions and money. You know.
I loved very much. Thank you for speaking. It had lots of personal resonances for me with my parents my mother on one side, my parents having actually fled Islington. Her parents then fled in Islington in the interwar period, from a house that I don't think any of us here could probably dream of ever owning now, and going out to the outer suburbs. Of course, this has felt to a new Spectles estate. And on my father's side, my grandfather actually being one of those who built bylaw houses in Tottenham, in Woodbury, right. Tottenham. And also his own, including his own house.
Was that him, the picture?
No. You'd have recognised him with very long ears. So I'm finding this very, very interesting from that level, but also this importance of perception and how outsiders perceive. My first job on leaving school was as a community development officer in an estate, a bylaw street estate, which was being progressively demolished to be upgraded. It was very badly looked down on from outside, and people wanted to stay in it inside. I'm not quite sure how much I won or lost in that we did actually save it from any further demolition. But it's now a conservation area and a completely different population inside. So I'm not quite sure about that. But anyway, thank you very much. And I hope to see you all again on fireworks night. You can avoid the fireworks and come and have a different sort of fireworks here. Stefan Matasius is going to be speaking to us about high-density point blocks and mixed development. And this, of course, is something which he's very well known for having researched and written on. He says about how a sizable minority consists of British estates, consisted of groups of 3 to 4 story blocks of flats, and a very small minority of higher blocks, that he's going to be talking about these point blocks in relation to mixed development then. So again, 6:30 for 7. 7 we begin the lecture, but 6:30 we meet and chat and meet each other. Hope to see you then. And if you haven't left your details so we can contact you, do. There are also membership forms. You're going to discount each time and get kept in touch more. And, hope to see you then. And thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.